the art of the cold open is something that's not really that appreciated. You turn the mic on, you start rolling, and you start talking to introduce the show. People think, oh, that's easy. It's not. It involves a lot of time, a lot of thought, and sometimes a little bit of humor, and oftentimes a lot of heart. Well, I didn't have any of that today, but anyway, it's a brand new SmartLess. SmartLess. A few weeks ago, now it's a few weeks ago, Jason and I went up to Pebble Beach, as you know, and then you came up with Scotty.
Right.
Like little angels flying up.
That's very nice.
It was really nice of you to do that.
We were so happy to do it.
It was very generous of you. And Sean is very generous. You're a very, very good friend and you have a very generous spirit.
Well, I love you both very much.
We love you very much.
Will and I were talking how we could both learn something from you.
Yeah, we were.
me more than Will.
That's going to be like a seminar.
Yeah.
Yeah, him more than you, meaning that he has more to learn than I do is what he meant.
Yeah, no, I think they got it.
Wait, Will, are you really that tired still?
Dude, we got home last night.
Oh, that's right. Well, I saw Jason last night for
I feel great. Will's a little more tired than I am because he did a lot more winning than I did.
Wait a minute. Let's talk about that.
I made the cut.
So, listener, this was a golf tournament, listener.
It was a Pebble Beach Pro-Am.
Too proud to say. But we are proud that it was to serve all the well-deserving charities up there in the Monterey Peninsula.
Get that in.
A bunch of really great people up there running that thing for years and years and years. And Willie and I did it this year. And Will came in second place in the closest to the whole contest.
That's amazing.
Which was incredible. And then the whole tournament itself, he made what is the coveted thing, which is to make the cut, which means that you're one of the top 25 teams that gets to play the final day.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It should be. Thank you.
Against, like, pros.
No. It should be noted. It should
alongside
be noted.
Pros.
It should be noted. My game is so bad, and I happened to get lucky on the holes that mattered where I could score. Other holes, you would have watched and you would have thought, now, this guy just stepped. He's never seen a golf club before, and he just stepped onto the course. Yeah. So some of them were so bad. My playing partner, my pro, was the Canadian guy, Taylor Pendrith.
Swift.
What's up, Taylor? Not Taylor Swift.
Okay.
That would have been interesting. And Taylor ended up doing quite well in the tournament, and I was texting with him afterwards, and we both agreed that I showed him all the shots not to hit. So that he could
do.
You
did provide value. What a great value.
But not to do.
So he'd be like, oh, don't do that. Huh. Don't do what he did. Don't. Anyway.
But let me ask you something. For as long as you guys were up there golfing, which was an entire week every day.
It was a long. My bad on that.
Like the repetitive motion of golfing, doesn't that like wreak havoc on your body every day?
Yes. I was tired. Definitely. And I said to Jason when he said, hey, we're going to go up the Sunday before and we're going to play that day and every day leading up to the tournament, I said, you don't think that's too much? He's like, there's no such thing as enough. This is what we're doing. We're going to prepare.
Well,
he's a total
duck. I have addiction issues. Yeah. It's probably for another podcast. But.
But you can't be addicted to playing golf.
Mm-hmm.
You'd be surprised.
You'd be surprised.
I can find a nice addiction in most things, but fortunately, it's all pointed towards healthy stuff.
Yeah,
nowadays.
Yeah.
I actually thought I was like, I don't want to play again. Jason and I are supposed to play Friday, and I thought I'm not going to play till Friday. I don't want to even look at my. And then this morning, I thought. I did have a good drive on 18 yesterday in the final hole at Pebble.
The weather's so nice today.
I might just go work on that just to capitalize on that.
Did you go hit balls today?
I almost did. Like a sicko. And I was like,
someone's a sicko.
Listen, did you get sick of the food? Wasn't it the same food every single night for an entire week? Wasn't it like eating in a dorm?
No. There's really nice restaurants up
great
there.
Great restaurants. And really great folks up there, yeah.
I did take advantage of the opportunity to eat a bunch of things I wouldn't normally find in my home.
That's true. It was fun to watch Jason eat. I will say, to watch him eat food.
Well, you ordered
was
well,
really
before
fun.
I even hit the table each time. I'd ask the hostess taking us to the table, "Do you guys have fried calamari or anything?"
And then they go. Now, you were there, Sean. And they go, "Would you guys like something to drink?" And we were like, "Yeah, I'll get some water, and I'll take a Diet Coke." And Jason goes, "Yeah, and if you can find any bread back there," I go, "Do you want them to put that in a glass with ice?" Like, they're getting drink orders, asking for bread,
just any sort of carbs. Sweet, salty.
But then you eat so healthy, these massive salads, and then Will ordered fried calamari, and you were just fucking digging into
this
that.
This is why
thing.
I eat healthy, so I can splurge when I really want it and eat it.
I know.
With like a shovel.
I know.
It's unbelievable.
Then, Sean, we had a nice time, and then Jason left early to go get a massage or give a massage. I can't remember which one you said.
Again, another different podcast probably.
Sure. So... And then we had some dessert. You and Scotty and I had some nice dessert.
Yeah, I ordered extra ice cream on mine, and you had the tiramisu.
I did.
You do love ice cream, right, Sean? And it's not like exotic flavors. It's just you're a vanilla guy, aren't you?
That's it.
Truly.
Just vanilla.
God.
Yeah. And also for ice cream too, right?
Wait, but do you know something?
Wait, but do you know something?
I'm not making this up. Do you know why people like the taste of vanilla?
Oh boy, insert joke.
No.
Because it makes them feel alive.
Yeah. Why is that, robot?
No, because it reminds them of the taste of mother's milk.
Huh.
Huh.
Yeah, it's the closest thing to the taste of mother's milk.
9 out of 10 babies were pulled on this? And they,
there's got to be a one-eyed mother joke in there somewhere. We'll work on it.
I know. It's the Wonder Bread of ice cream, let's be honest, though. I love ice cream too. Let's just do this before we get to our guest. Jason's your guest today, right? So I'm sure they're waiting.
Yeah, it is. Let's tighten it up.
What number one dessert? They go, you get one shot for one dessert for the rest of your life. You only get one more. What is the thing that you're having? Jason, you go first. One.
Longer.
I mean, I'm just surprised myself with cobbler came to my mind.
What kind?
That's not bad.
Any kind of cobbler.
That's not bad.
Warm fruit.
Peach, berry, rhubarb, whatever it is, because I like that crumbly, graham crackery
Right, so if you had one, okay, cobbler. Okay. Like Shawnee?
Well, you know it already.
Just one scoop of vanilla ice cream?
Vanilla ice cream,
like
really?
Massive scoop of ice cream with like Hershey syrup and whipped cream on it, like a sundae.
Okay, like a sundae.
You're trash. You're just trash.
You're trash.
Okay. Because I was going to say that if that was your last meal, like it was like... Like you were about to go before the firing squad, and you asked for a scoop of vanilla ice cream. I'd be like, just shoot him now.
Yeah,
forget it. Just right in the mouth. Just shoot him. Yes. I think I would take. My thing is, I would have. Would be cake.
Yeah. What kind? Yeah,
like a yellow cake with chocolate frosting.
That's all that is. Remember the cake lady? Did the cake lady make you that?
The cake lady. She did. She made me a cake.
Yeah, that's pretty generic.
But I do love a cobbler, though. You know, they also make like
You can't have any of mine.
No, I know. But like an apple brown Betty, have you ever had that before? It's like a cobbler, too. It's so good with
I love that.
Anyway.
But I can't do warm fruit other than apples.
No.
Insert joke here, Will. Go ahead.
No, you mean
no warm fruit jokes?
Well, Mykonos comes to mind. It's filled
in the summertime.
They're really
kind of all in.
They're really warm.
You make an exception.
No, I mean that they have a lot of figs.
Yeah,
nice. I get what you've done there. Leave it.
I haven't done a fucking thing.
You have. You did it. Okay. Great opening patter. Incredible. But something that's even more incredible.
What's that?
Today is
so exciting.
Sean?
Merch Madness.
That's short for merchandise, everybody. And it's a little pun on the basketball tournament. All in one. So you're welcome.
And it's like
You think they don't know that?
Yeah, well, sometimes you got to explain. Tracy, she doesn't understand college basketball or the short term for merchandise.
No, the reason we started giving Tracy, informing her of stuff was because it was all inside showbiz stuff. Now you're just getting to, you think she doesn't know just basic life stuff?
She also doesn't know about college basketball.
What are you talking about? She lives in Wisconsin, man.
But here's what the listener needs to know. Is that this merch store has got...
It's got
smartless t-shirts and phone
joggers.
Cases and... And there are people on there that jog, right? There's joggers.
Mm-hmm. There's sweats. The sweats are great. The hats are great.
Yep.
All this stuff is great. And it's for the fans. For just like, you know, like that want a piece of us.
Well, that sounds gross. They don't like us that much. But if you want some fun, if you're sick and tired of your phone case and you want Sean's dumbass face on your phone, go to www.wonderyshop.com/smartless.
By the way, you only said two W's. You said www. Like a fucking dummy. First of all, nobody says
World
that anymore.
War II.
But at least if you are going to do it, say all three.
WWW. Yeah.
There you go.
That's World Wide Web. That's short for World Wide Web. Did you know that?
Yes, World Wide Web.
Wondryshop.com/smartless.
Don't need to sing it.
Why not?
Here we go. Our guest today is a friend, a filmmaker, an innovator, and an actor.
Oh.
I've been lucky enough to work with him a few times, and he is as much fun to work with as he is to hang around with. he's acted in about 50 movies, directed 9 movies, made a couple of TV shows, and a couple of children. And by the way, he's responsible for the best Christmas movie ever and for basically starting Marvel's presence in Hollywood. Please welcome Mr. John Favreau. Get it out here, John. I'm so glad you're still awake. I'm sorry for the long patter up front.
That's amazing. I listened to the pod. Are they always that long at the top, or only when you're excited to get into the ring? It's weird. I'm a little starstruck for Smartless, even though individually I'm quite comfortable with all of you.
Johnny Favreau, oh my gosh, it's so nice to see you.
John, you're so
thanks
cool.
Thanks for repping. By the way, I know, listener, you can't see, but there's a Baby Yoda on the shelf behind Sean up there. And you didn't do that just for me.
No, yeah, he has no idea.
You didn't know it was going to be me.
That's Grogu.
I'm touched.
Exactly. Will and I need to clear the decks because Sean's going to take this interview over. He climbs up your
Scotty.
Star
let's,
Wars
let's get
colon.
Into it. Let's
no,
get
but
into
Scotty,
it.
Get pull up a chair for Scotty.
Scotty
and go ahead, out. Guys.
But Johnny, I told you at that last dinner. I think it was like a year ago. That how much like I'm so impressed and like beyond. I can't even believe
it's ridiculous.
You. Like I just think you're amazing. But let's start there. Don't you hate it when people call it Baby Yoda? His name's Grogu.
People have lots of different, you know, there's Strider and Aragorn. There's, you know, everybody's got lots of names. So,
yeah, Sean, just because people can enjoy it, just because they don't know the fucking nerd name for the fucking the puppet.
No, but in all fairness, in the beginning, it was confusing because people thought it was actually Yoda as a baby, and that just threw off the time frame.
But it is Yoda as a baby.
Confused people. No.
Oh, it's not. It threw off. The time frame was wrong.
It's not. Go
Yoda
ahead, John.
Yoda's long gone.
Dress down Sean right now.
Grogu shows up. Because this is after Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
Dumb.
Right. God, when Luke Skywalker showed up in the last fucking episode of The Mandalorian.
Guys, cool it. The ladies are getting so heated up listening
we'll
to this.
We'll get to Flaked soon. By the way, fan of Flaked. No, I watched every episode of Flaked.
No, you
and
did
I'm waiting
not.
For, yeah, I sure did. Oh, let's do the Flaked quiz. I'm ready.
Go,
I
Willie.
Was devoted to that show. And I like the neighborhood, too, because Venice, I know the neighborhood. You really captured Venice.
It was like Venice porn. It was Venice porn, and we had the great Wally Pfister, who directed a bunch in the first season, and he set the tone of how
beautiful.
It would look. I think it's the
I
most
love pretty, that yeah. show. I really
thanks,
did.
Man. I really appreciate that. But so, wait. So let's lay this to rest once for all. I thought it was Baby Yoda, too. I really did. So what's the deal? It's Grogan?
Get Scotty in here.
That's the anime show I'm working on, Grogan. No, Grogu is the name, as was revealed. He's a baby of the same species as you.
Well, that's what I meant.
Yes, no, you're right. You're right in that regard.
Did they do like a species reveal? Did they do like a big
it was green. Yeah. We popped the balloon and it was green.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. There's so many things
I
can ask you.
So Mandalorian. So before we get into the Marvel stuff, because I want to know this too, and I've known you a long time, but I don't understand how, because you are, in a lot of ways, this might be controversial. You kind of started the Marvel.
I said it in the intro.
In a way, right?
I directed Iron Man, and with Mr. Downey, our mutual friend, our mutual friends. That was the first MCU film.
Yeah, you and Downey created a monster, a BMO, whatever it is.
And had you shit the bed on that,
it would have been
Hollywood
bad.
Would not be floating today. telling you. I mean, it is the big balloon that keeps it all up.
There are a lot of people earning $25, $30 million paychecks, actors, who should be calling you and thanking you and cutting you a check every month, by the way.
You get a muffin basket or anything from...
I get muffins.
Like, Mrs. Chris Beasley Evans or the Downies of the world.
Mrs. Beasley.
So you're part of that, not just part of it. You help create that whole world, the MCU. But then, all of a sudden... You're doing The Mandalorian and you're doing all this other stuff, and now you're like creating this part of this other whole universe. How did that come about? All that stuff.
Yeah,
I was doing. So I had done the Marvel film.
How did you get chosen, or how did you pit like for Iron Man?
Remember back then it wasn't a big deal, right? It was it was a little bit like Moneyball, where they were finding undervalued talent.
Sure.
A utility director.
I had a good on-base average. Uh-huh. I was a salty old knuckleballer that knew how to get people out, but I didn't have a sexy heater. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right? Am I saying that right, Jason?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. And Downey was your Mickey Hatcher.
He was the guy, you know? He was, again, worked for, you know, wanted the gig, really fought for it, too. And,
did he really?
Oh yeah. He actually had to read, believe it or not, to convince the people.
Do you
people.
Still have that tape?
I think it's out there. I think it's public. Like it's on YouTube. Yeah, he was amazing from the first time it was so obvious.
Yeah,
and I knew that if I had him in that role, like I got the whole tone. And then, of course, after he signed on, all the other actors wanted to work on this thing because of him and because of the tone of what it was going to be, because everybody was really a fan of his from way back. And so we pulled together a really great cast, like an independent film, and we found that tone, and combined it with the CGI. CGI was good enough at that point to do hard surfaces like a metal suit flying, and so people really got to see something that you wouldn't have been able to portray a few years before. That all started to build momentum, and they started to launch other franchises off of that, leading to the Avengers. And after that, I did Cowboys and Aliens after that.
I love that movie.
So I was back on the naughty list after that one.
Was another admirably, big swing that you took on and I thought did a great job with.
Thank you. It didn't do well at the box office, and you know how it is in Hollywood. That's not, they don't like when that happens.
Right.
So there I was, I cooled off a bit, and worked my way back up with the movie Chef, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that kind of got me back.
Which I told you, Favreau, I remember telling you specifically in person how great I think that movie is to this day.
You.
Not was, is, because it exists and it's a great, that is a great movie. If you haven't seen Jon Favreau's Chef, I implore you to go see
it's
it.
So good.
It's so good, dude.
Yeah.
I appreciate
really
that.
Really great.
Oh. Thank you. Love and it was a special one because it was like, I started off doing smaller films where I would write them and be in them and or direct them. And then it was nice to be able to still be able to do that and find something that I could really feel passionate about. That one didn't have a big budget, but it did really well for what it cost. And then I ended up, because of my visual effects background, getting involved with, I think the next thing was Jungle Book. And that was a hit. And then I really started to get under the hood with the CGI and the effects. And I was a bit of a Luddite in the beginning. I kind of shied away from CGI, mostly because it wasn't done well in most films. And as I learned more and more about it, I started to help innovate the tools to make CGI, I think, look better than it had. And then we did Lion King after that.
The wall thing.
For The Mandalorian, we created real-time rendering.
Not Stargate.
ILM calls it Stagecraft.
Stagecraft.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's basically using game engine technology in video walls and creating parallax so you can move the camera. And the backgrounds are basically captured in camera instead of after the fact.
But what makes it efficient for what Sean calls the wall thing is that thank you, Sean.
Incredible.
You can basically shoot one direction all the time and just keep changing the background.
The actor feels like they're actually there.
Right. So it's not green screen, right? So yeah. You could see so the actors could see the background, yeah. But it allows you, yeah, Will, to film and just change over like you would with a video game, what the backgrounds are and all
that.
Like
acting
preloaded
in front of a movie screen.
We use that in the in Our Flag Means Death that I did with Taika and those guys.
Oh yeah, that's right. It was very well used there too. Yeah. I thought for the ocean.
Is that what
they
used in Gravity, the movie Gravity?
So Gravity, they used a system that definitely inspired what we were doing. It didn't have all the parallax, but it would create interactive light with LED panels, which is what we surround the set with.
Yeah.
They would have individual panels on a Bot and Dolly system, which is basically a robot that was used for car construction, so they could move in and out light sources, creating interactive light on the astronauts, and then when they put the backgrounds in, the interactive light is really the hard part to do in post-production. Mm-hmm. So Alfonso Cuarón, they came up with a great system that we ended up using panels like that in Jungle Book. So everybody's sort of taken baby steps, but around similar technologies. And we just had a big breakthrough on
Mandalorian. Just hearing you talk about this stuff, and you're a smart guy.
You're like
and obviously
today's Douglas Trumbull.
Yeah, quick learner. I mean, you came up, you're making... I mean, you're making independent film. A lot of people got to know you from the film that you wrote, obviously, Swingers, which is one of the all-time great, one of the most quotable films of all time to
this
day.
And I moved here the year that came out, and it was L.A., you know, Bay. I was just, like, blown away by, like, me having the experience that you wrote and directed on the screen at the same time.
And from Chicago, too, right? Yeah. We were both.
And from Chicago. And, Sean, because Sean's so money, he doesn't even know how money is, but... But so, because you've got these claws and you don't even know how to get these claws. So,
oh my God!
So, I'm going deep.
So, you got it all.
So,
I'm blushing.
I know. So anyway,
Here though, big shout out to the man who is the best at what he does. Vince Vaughn is
a
genius. Yes. And a big hello to him.
If you want to laugh your fucking face off, stand next to Vince Vaughn for 1 minute.
Yeah. I just worked with him like a couple weeks ago on Curb.
Oh, really?
One really quick thing.
I was hoping he'd be back. Yeah. What's it like to work on that show? I'm such a fan. He's great on it,
too.
Oh, my
God. Yeah. It's crying laughing.
He's so fun. So I went to this charity event a few years ago, and I ended up sitting next to Vince, and the guy who was running it was this sort of older guy, and he was not good at doing it. And Vince was in my ear the whole time, and he kept going, "This is the face man that they picked? this is the face man?" And I was crying. And everybody's looking at me.
There's no one faster.
Because he's in my ear, and I'm crying.
No, forget it.
But who even has that term, face man, at the ready?
Dude, he killed me with face man. But I want to get back to my original point.
But before we get off that, one of my favorite Bateman performances is in a Vince Vaughn film in Dodgeball. That's the Ocho when you're on the Ocho. That was with the hair, and that was like a half day. You told me once
it was about a half day.
It is some of the fun. Let's just go around the horn just for one more second. Another one of the almost funniest moments that if people have not seen it, first of all, you got to see Bateman in Dodgeball. But second of all, I went to a screening. I actually introed a screening, did a Q&A, and didn't know you were in it. But Downey's film Senior. You and Downey with the piano, with him singing in Lederhosen. Sean, sorry, I'm pointing. Sean, I don't know if you've not seen it yet.
That movie
is like the
incredible.
Funniest 3 minutes of film that I could remember seeing.
But an incredibly
when you
moving documentary.
Are there with the water bottles, like armful of water bottles for no reason. It's just like really serious documentary. And then Sean comes in there and just starts like Harpo Marx and just starts ripping it up. And the piano, when you tell him to start again.
Yeah.
And then his father, just for those who don't know, Robert's father had some input in how this documentary was being made. And one of his requests is that he sang a certain song in Lederhosen as part of it. What was the song that you were playing, accompanying? Because you're a great piano player.
Schubert.
And you were accompanying him. What was the bit?
It was Schubert's some opera piece, you know, like a
something grand,
standard classic. Yeah.
And he could really sing and you could really play. And there he is in Lederhosen with Sean being a very difficult taskmaster. It's just a wonderful little moment of cinema there. But anyway, I'm sorry.
Sean, were we at Downey's for lunch that a couple of summers ago when he asked you to do it? He just sort of said,
no, it was on the podcast.
It was on the podcast, right? Yeah. That's what I thought.
Where you were, yeah.
Yes, we were out there, and then you were like, yeah. And then all of a sudden, like you're in the middle of it,
and he's like,
you
learn. Maybe, And he goes, maybe you should wear a tuxedo and I'll wear a lederhosen. And I go, I don't understand what's happening. I don't understand this movie.
Oh, you look like you were very comfortable.
And didn't you say we'll talk about it lederhosen? And he said, that's how you came up with it? Isn't that how that happened?
And he laughed and I said, lederhosen.
And lederhosen.
Yeah, exactly.
And now, a word from our sponsor. We get support from Canva. When your work, presentations, and docs look good, you look good. And you can design stunning work presentations, docs, whiteboards, and videos with Canva. Canva is an easy-to-use online design platform. It helps people design compelling visual content and is great for designing any type of presentation and great for any teammate. So our team at Smartless is using Canva when they're coming up with different design concepts for various things with related to Smartless and Smartless Media, because we have a lot of stuff going on. It's a busy crew, okay? And if it wasn't for Canva, they'd all be fired. Supercharge your work with AI-powered Canva presentations, docs, videos, and more. In just a few seconds, you can generate slides and text from a prompt. AI is built into Canva right where you work, so you can stay on task without any app switching. It's AI that's easy to learn and even easier to use. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva is perfect for any work task. Sales decks, hiring docs, marketing brainstorms, employee videos, you name it. Anyone at work can design with Canva. Start designing today at canva.com. Designed for work. Thank you to one of our new sponsors, My Mochi Ice Cream, for supporting the show. I just discovered cookies and cream, My Mochi Ice Cream, and I'm a little obsessed, but I'm a lot obsessed. Do you not know what My Mochi Ice Cream is? Picture this. It's a perfect little scoop of rich, creamy, premium ice cream wrapped in the softest, sweetest dough known to mankind. My Mochi Ice Cream is sweet. It's chewy. It's cool. It's creamy all at the same time. It comes in tons of fabulous flavors like strawberry, mango, cookies and cream, and double chocolate. That cookies and cream, I've always been a cookies and cream fan, but then when I had the My Mochi, oh my gosh, I mean, I was like, my mouthy loved it. First of all, an absolute knockout. Each box of My Mochi ice cream has 6 perfectly portioned mochis that are gluten-free and about 90 calories each. You can find My Mochi at Target or go to mymochi.com to find your nearest grocery store. Discover the cool, creamy, joyfully chill sensation of My Mochi ice cream today.
Hey, Smartless listener, we get support from Viator. You know, Scotty and I took a vacation many years ago. We geeked out because we liked the movie Amadeus, and we went to Austria, and it was fantastic. We went to all Mozart's kind of hangout places, and I know, total nerdville, but it was pretty cool, and I absolutely loved it. It will always be one of our favorite memories of vacationing, so maybe one of the most perfect experiences we've ever had traveling. And so next time you're looking to plan the perfect trip like that, an experience, check out Viator. Viator is a tool you can use to plan and book travel experiences around the world. Their app and website make it easy to explore 300,000 plus travel experiences so you can discover what's out there no matter where you are traveling or what you are interested in. Feel better about your travel decisions by checking out real traveler reviews to get the inside scoop from others who have already checked out the experiences. Viator offers 24/7 customer service so you know you'll get support at any hour if things aren't going as planned. Plus, free cancellation to help you plan for the unexpected. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find the perfect travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
And now back to the show.
But anyway, so all right, so John, so you make, but you make like a seminal independent comedy, which people don't really make anymore, that has stood the test of time. You did all these things. You were an actor, blah, blah, and then all of a sudden you become a director, and not just a director, but a director who's making films that are very complicated, that using all these effects, and as you
and
say,
helping develop technology too,
and helping like, develop technology,
like a new George Lucas.
That is a whole skill set that you didn't know that you had to learn on the job. Is that right?
It was baby steps up, but honestly. I know we've had conversations. Bateman and I have had conversations when we started, you know, as Jason was starting to direct. And it's like you learn what's great about being an actor is it's like the best seat in the house to learn because you get to ask a million questions. You work with these talented people, mm-hmm. and you can learn. It's almost like an apprenticeship if you want to. Like you can ask a million questions. I started off doing like background work. I think you did too. Sean in Chicago.
Absolutely. Mad Dog and Glory.
He's back at it. He's back to it. It was his true passion.
His sports fold-out chair.
You always go back to your
back
first
to
love.
Basics. I think I,
yeah,
I think
it's, you got to stay humble. Yeah.
That's great. Stay humble. Good for you. But, you know, you sit there and you're watching and they don't let you, like, close to anything or, you know, they keep you in holding and you get to be on the set. It feels like a treat.
Yeah.
And then you're like listening to everything everybody's saying and you're watching. And then when I finally got a supporting role on the movie Rudy out of Chicago.
Yeah. So great.
Also, hold for applause.
Thank you. Thanks, listener. There I started asking questions of the DP and they let me come around the editing room and learn.
Did somebody famous shoot that? Didn't somebody famous shoot that?
Wood shot that.
Well, I'm thinking of somebody else, but I'm sure Oliver he was Wood. Very, very good.
Great cinematographer.
But you got to kind of see the inside of that movie a little
you
bit?
You got to ask questions, I guess, is my point. Yeah. And like, I was always super curious, and even like when I moved, I grew up in New York, I was in Chicago for a while learning improv, and I finally got to come here on the heels of that role. And
how old
I
were
felt,
you and Rudy?
Oh, 26, I feel like.
Yeah.
I feel like I was 30 when Swingers came out. So I was like 20. I think I moved out here at 26. Yeah.
But yeah, so and you went to Chicago. You were at I.O. You were at Improv Olympic in Chicago with all those people. So you knew a lot
Second
of the same
City.
People that we know in common, who some came out here and some went to New York.
And I was washing dishes at Second City. So I got to watch every night Farley on stage. I got to watch great improvisers like Dave Pasquese and Tim Meadows, Mike Myers was there.
Yeah.
When I was there, I was like, it was intimidating because I was like, those are just like undiscovered, normal like people. I was like,
it's also
wow.
a really hard thing to learn. You can watch as much as you want, but if you don't have that little engine inside that, you know, doesn't make you any better or worse a person, it's just something you kind of are born with or not, I think. And how early did you know that you had that? Because just in my incredible research on
Wikipedia,
it says that there's a Bear Stearns stop for you before any of this. Like, so how when do you transition from interest in the financial world to going to Chicago to chase a dream based on what I'm assuming you knew you may have had inside, which is
I like there was no pressure on me, so it was like school plays, and that was just fun time for me.
Yeah.
And like improv was great because like when people went up on their lines, that was the most fun. Like when you could be on stage and get out of that. But I never thought it was an option. I got a gig at Bear Stearns because a friend's father was able to hire an assistant, so I was there for a year before the market crashed in the 80s, and I just wrapped my head around that I'd have to work a job like this for my whole life. I wasn't enjoying it. And finally, I went cross country and I stopped in Chicago on that trip.
So brave.
And that's when I saw people doing improv in Chicago. I had a friend who was taking classes at I.O. and at Second City. And I was like, this is the best. And I was, again, in my 20s. I think I was 22 at the time.
Wow.
And I knew how to bartend. And I hit up the people. I had done some volunteer. I volunteered to be on stage. And they did. The first thing I remember, they interviewed me about my day, right? It was an improv game at I.O. called The Dream, where they interview you about what happened that day. Mm-hmm. And then they improvise in front of you what your nightmare is going to be like that night based on your events. Right?
That's a great idea.
So they did that with me. And I was, you know, on stage doing an interview, getting some laughs. And then Chris Farley played me.
Oh, as nice.
That was my first experience seeing improv. was Chris Farley playing me and watching them really improvise. Because, you know, when you see good improv, you think, oh, is that just shtick they have up their sleeve?
Right.
But I know they improvised all because it was all coming off of my interview. And I was completely flabbergasted.
What's funny, John, is that, and you mentioned, and I guess, was Del Close there around that time?
Yeah, that was Del.
Del must have been, yeah. And so you go there, because what we all know, and people say, like, oh, I watched this movie, and they're such great improvisers. It's different. People who come from Chicago and people who know what improvising really means, what a herald is, and to tell a story and to bring stuff back, it's different from, like, when you watch people who are like, oh, they came up with a different way of saying dick. Like, that's not improvising.
A different take, yeah. And some people, right, you're absolutely right. And there are some people, like you talk about Vince, like Vince, like nobody as quick as
But you
that
and Vince
guy.
Together, let's not forget about you. You guys are an incredible team with that stuff.
Yeah but he's, I just hang on because he's just so damn fast. You know what I mean? And just hold the reality and be a good straight man. Maybe I get a laugh here and there. But you see people like him, and he came out of Chicago also. Yeah. But you're right. If people could improvise like a whole scene, that's different than doing a freebie take where you could get a laugh.
Yeah, where you
Curb,
get a laugh.
Curb does that, though, right? Don't they do entire shows, right?
Yeah, there's
yeah
no
they have
script,
a sort of a basic story, and then they but I'm talking more like the IO stuff, like all that stuff, and then all the UCB guys did, like Amy and Matt and Ian and
McKay.
Tina and all.
McKay was there. McKay when I was there. Yeah,
I mean, Adam McKay is one of the great improvisers on stage.
So he's funny as hell. Like people don't know because he's like a award winning writer director.
I know.
Yeah.
But those people. But I credit all my like knowledge of writing and directing from doing long form improv, because you have to edit, you have to write, you have to see patterns in scenes, you have to have callbacks, bring scenes back. And when you first start writing, it's really just like improvising with yourself and using all the rules that you learned around improvisation, heighten and transform, those things that you learn just to get you through. When they stick you on stage at a bar, and sometimes people don't even know there's going to be a comedy show, and you really learn how to swim.
Yeah. You know? Do you miss it, John?
I don't. I really don't. I miss that. I would be scared to come up doing improv now, because there's like everybody's got phones and everybody, like there was so much room to fail.
Yeah.
And in Chicago, there was nobody, you could
just do anything.
And I feel like there's so much pressure, like on a first film, on a first role. People make up their minds about people's skill and talent based on the first time out, but you have to get things wrong a lot before you get it right.
Yeah,
but you know, to that point though, you do strike me as somebody who is incredibly courageous, and you needn't look any further than probably that move from what on paper was probably a solid, predictable way to go in your life, which is going into finance. And then you said, this might not be a great fit. Let me go try driving across the country and stopping in Chicago and seeing if I can accomplish my dreams. And talk a little bit about what, because that's very applicable to anybody listening in any occupation, just kind of listening to yourself and tacking left or right based on an instinct.
Yeah, and saying, I'm going nowhere here, and I'm not going to be happy. As you said, I could see that I'm not going to be happy. I need to make that change. And Jason said, it's brave.
Yeah. What do you, did your parents give you a lot of confidence? Were you born with it, or?
They kind of pushed me. I lost my mom when I was pretty young. So that definitely affects your whole trajectory.
Yeah.
But I would say that my folks both gave me a sense of confidence. I had a supportive family. Like if I was ever on stage or did something creative, I was an only child that was very, appreciated. Like I never questioned my own, you know, if I had something to offer of value. I always
felt
you
got some attaboys for doing that.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, so I there's a lot of credit there. And, you know, as a parent, you realize how important that is now and with your kids to do it, because that's their foundation, right? That's like, that gives them their base and their stability, because they're going to hit headwinds and there's going to be a lot of things telling them they're not doing the right thing.
Right.
And if they go down to deep memories and they have a sense of worth and confidence, I think that gets them through a lot of, gives them a good keel.
Yeah, firm, amen.
Right? So there's that. But then there's also like just realizing, because I was, on the other hand, it was like I was not really permitted to study things in school that weren't academic. I was pushed towards academics. Away from, like, there are high schools in New York, like performing arts and stuff and art and design, and, you know, where it would have been fun, I would have liked to have done that. My folks were, no, go into the sciences, and you have to pick a pragmatic course so that you have stability. We didn't come from, you know, we didn't have a lot of dough. So you had to pick a career where you could have some stability. But then finally, like, and so my all my associations with play was like after school, mm-hmm. taking an elective in college. Like, it was all positive. I never felt pressure. It was always playtime for me.
Right.
So when it came time for me to write or do sketch comedy, it was all fun. I felt people who picked the career earlier felt a lot of pressure. I don't know what it was like, Jason, because I know you were at it. You were a pro from the beginning. But I never felt like there was that I had to compete in any way. Anything I was doing was just a lark, and my family got a kick out of it.
Jason once told me, you told me this when you were like 12 years old and you had a scene, right, in Little House on the Prairie, and yeah. you had to cry and you weren't doing it, and your dad whispered in your ear and he said, if you don't cry in this scene, we don't eat tonight.
Right.
Yeah. No, right? Did he say that?
Yeah.
We don't eat tonight.
Right. And I wrote it on the inside of my wrist. It's still there today.
I hope that's a joke.
So John, so first of all, what part of, did you grow up in the city? Did you grow up on Long Island?
No, Queens. I was a Queens guy.
Oh, you were in Queens. Okay, great. Yeah.
Flushing.
So, yeah.
And Forest Hills, yeah.
Right near the Trump wing of that. What's that?
I moved around. Queens hasn't had a good showing in the last.
God. Anyway, so you grew up in Queens.
Paul Simon.
There we go. Okay, Paul Simon. Ray Romano.
Seinfeld.
Ray Romano. We love Ray Romano.
Yes, yeah. That's right. He is from Queens.
So you move out to New York. You do the Bear Stearns thing. So now you're there. You're.
Oh, I didn't move to New York. I was commuting.
You were in
Queens.
New York. I mean, you went from yeah. Queens to Chicago. Is what
the
I
the fantasy is. You move to the city, but no, that was not my life.
That never happened. Well, you skipped it.
I was like Tony Manero. I was taking the bridge.
Tunnel. Oh, right. Just like Saturday Night Fever. So you go out to Chicago. You start working at Second City and IO, and you're doing.
And that's
when
I was like, this. Now I'm doing what I love to do. That's when my life kicked into gear. Like, it was like, it was all gravy at that point. I was working, seating people and washing dishes at Second City and selling T-shirts there and doing, starting
and your
to do
dad,
artwork.
You're checking in with your dad, and your dad's like, how's it going? You're like, I'm killing it.
He loved it, too.
He loved it.
Like, he was all into it, too, because my dad was great, because he was like, he says, you're 22. When I called him from Chicago, I'm like, I think I want to do this. After that show I saw, mm-hmm. He says, you know what? You're old enough to know, like, to make a responsible decision, but you're young enough that if you're wrong, you could still do something else.
That's awesome.
And so that was a permission that I got, and I really embraced it.
What a great thing to say to your kid who calls excited about something. That is so fucking great. So I love that. How does it come about that you write Swingers? What was that?
That was also my dad, I would say, because he gave me a copy of Final Draft, you know,
the writing
I'm
software.
Not sponsored in any way by...
sure, that's okay.
I have to say it's a podcast. There's no...
Wait, you just got a free sponsor. Update. You just got
Tracy,
a free
update. Tracy, if you want to write a script, there's a formatting piece of software that where you can type in dialogue. It comes out looking like a script.
So it does, but that's really it, because you start writing...
If you want to send Jason a script, he's got... Sorry.
You start typing and it formats it, and I had read a lot of scripts because I was acting, right? Because I had come out here on the heels of Rudy, which was, by the way, to get a role like I got in Rudy out of Chicago, that was
so
like
lucky.
A home run.
So rare, though, too.
So rare. Because they were shooting local, and they were looking for local talent to save some money.
And you just auditioned for it in Chicago.
Yeah. And I improvised a lot in the audition, and David Anspaugh and Angelo Pizzo, the director and the writer.
But so many actors, because I was there too at that time, so many actors would scramble and just like kill for one of those roles of the movies that came through Chicago, because there were so few, unless it was a John Hughes film.
You have the John Hughes movies. I was just about to say, and I was an extra on a lot of John Hughes movies. You know,
I love that.
Really?
That was, yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, I got called back for, what's that Sandy Bullock movie?
While You're Sleeping.
Sweet. Yeah, I was an orderly. I'm still waiting to hear if I got it.
Well,
great story. So John, thanks for interrupting, John.
Sorry.
So you get Rudy, you get cast out of Chicago.
Get an agent.
The
producers from that say when you come out, if you come out to L.A., because I thought it was like what they would do, Sean, if you remember, is people would work and live in L.A. in Chicago, and then they'd come out here for like pilot season.
That's right.
Same as New York. We would do it too. We would come out for 2 months.
But when I came out, they were like, okay, you got to tell everybody you really live here. Otherwise, they're not going to want to. And then next thing you know is like, oh, no, you really do have to move out here.
Right.
So it was like I didn't realize I was moving out there. And right. And so I would read a lot of scripts and audition a lot. So I had enough heat off of that movie before it came out that I was getting to go to auditions. Right. And when you go to auditions, you read a lot of scripts. And also I would improv a lot in my, because I was usually like the comedic, like supporting friend. Right. And so they loved if I threw in some jokes and punched up their stuff. And then when I got the final draft program, I just started writing. And next thing you know, you get like four pages. And now I'm writing about me and, you know, inspired by my friends and what we would do hanging out. And there was
Were you buddies with Vince at the time?
I met him on Rudy.
Yeah, okay.
I met him on Rudy.
And he moved out to LA roughly the same time, maybe?
He was out here already. So it was a lot like the movie where he was showing me around and showing me the ropes and here's where you hang out and we go to Vegas and stuff like that. So it was very much inspired by, you know, it's his, you know, and everything he says in the movie, even if I wrote it, it was based on conversations that we had or things that he would say. Right. Exaggerations of it, but it was really channeling his humor and everything that he's, you know, how entertaining, as Will points out, how he is just as naturally as a person. And he was reading for roles that were, you know, he's a good-looking dude, so he was reading for all of these, like, either leads or the enemy of the lead, or, you know, he was always playing those kind of, they saw his face and didn't realize how funny he was. And so this was the first time he really got to be who he was, I think, on camera.
You know, I tell you, John, one of the scenes that I love about, and I think it's not unheralded, but in Swingers, is the moment when you guys are at the former 101 restaurant. Cafe 101.
Yeah.
It was right at the corner of Franklin.
And it wasn't even that then.
So there's that scene, and you guys are talking, and he's looking over your shoulder, and he's sort of like, oh, she's a little baby. Oh, and he thinks the woman is making eyes at him and waving. And he's like, she's playing a little game. And he's waving back at her. And then it turns out she has a little kid. She's got a baby across from her.
Right.
And that is based on something that really happened to Vince.
No way.
Yeah.
Really? In an airport.
No way.
Yes. Somebody was waving at him. And making faces.
Uh-huh.
And he was very off-put by it. And then finally they picked up a baby. Because you know how airports have the seats in the rows?
That's so funny.
So that was... You'll have to ask him about that.
What's so great about it is it's kind of tragic in that moment. It's at the end of the movie, and there's sort of a tragedy to it. It reminds me a lot of, you know, one of my favorite film of all time, With Nail and I. There's this kind of tragedy to it that's built in, and there I think that there's that there in that.
It worked nice because it was like, you know, it's. He found somebody, Mikey found somebody who he really connected with, and now he wasn't on that journey anymore. He was ready to, you know. So I think in that way there's sort of a disconnect that happens there. Maybe. I don't know. You know, it's not like you think about this stuff when you write it. It was honestly like him telling me the funniest thing just happened to me at the airport, and then I worked it into – the script.
Right, and you don't really think about this. You're not deliberate or strategic about it is you put into your stuff. You're just kind of putting in, whether it be writing, acting, or directing, or producing, stuff that resonates with you. It is your own personal taste. Mm-hmm. And you've learned how to use more and more and more tools at your disposal as a director to communicate
you're absolutely taste, right. And it's not conscious in any way, you know, and you learn to go to things that interest you or that you are drawn to, but you're making seemingly instinctive choices, but that doesn't mean that they're not valid. It's just that your conscious mind isn't doing it. It's coming from a deeper place. And so a lot of the writing you do or images you're drawn to, you might not even understand why they resonate, but you're really working through things subconsciously, I think. And that's one of the great gifts of being able to do what we do as a career is that you're really working through stuff, usually from a younger age.
But I will say, and not to embarrass you with a compliment, but your ability to bring the Favreau sensibility to what has become the industry-saving genre was something that I think folks will look back on as a real gift, because had somebody without your sensibility, comedically, you know, your sense of humanity, vulnerability, blah blah blah, to infuse that into a superhero comic book genre is would never mm-hmm. be expected. But right. your ability to kind of Trojan horse that in there, I mean, I guess that's my question. How much of that was part of your pitch as a director when you talked to the powers that be? Was it Kevin at the time?
I think what was cool about here's what's interesting. So I work on Elf, right? And yeah. with Elf,
we haven't even got to Elf yet.
Exactly. I'm gonna spend some time.
But that was what came before, right? That was sort of my hit that got me as a director. That's
right.
the first thing that I did. That
20 years ago.
20 years ago.
So well deserved.
And it was what's interesting to me is when you do a comedy, everybody's giving you a million notes about every joke,
right?
Yeah. Right? But they didn't care about any of the action stuff.
Right.
Not one note about like the sleigh chase or any of that stuff. When I went to Marvel, all they gave me notes on was my storyboards around the action sequences, and nobody cared at all about the dialogue.
Wow. Uh-huh.
So it actually gave me more permission to have my sense of humor in it, because my sense of humor isn't always like, not every joke lands. And like, if you're expecting it, you got to punch the joke, and like, it's not funny enough. But if it's not expected to be funny, and it's just kind of dry. Yeah,
it can be a grin.
Then it's a grin or just dialogue. Like they're not judging. You're not being
right.
And then when you cast Downey in there to bring in his sauce on top of that, it's a fringe benefit. It's an added asset that it didn't need to have. Right. I mean, if you just had the action, you know, apropos of the only thing they were noting
the personality of Marvel comics, like I grew up with, there was always a tongue in cheek kind of.
Okay, gotcha.
You know, it wasn't as like earnest as DC.
But they gave you, but by virtue of that, they were kind of like, do hit all these moments, this action stuff that's really important.
Right.
And the rest of it, you can have that. Yeah, sure.
And hit
go
this
for
budget. That was
and hit this budget. And then the stuff in between, go for it. If you want to have them be kind of interesting and be quirky and have a joke here and there, they're like, go for it. We're fine with that. And that's very freeing, I imagine.
But about Elf, though, I read a long time ago, or I don't know when, that you set out, I don't know if this is true, you tell me, to make a movie that was a classic Christmas film to be viewed for the rest of time. Like, that was the goal of that movie. And a lot of people, like, go into making stuff like that, but that doesn't happen. And it happened with you with that goal in mind. I mean, that's amazing.
That was the hope, you know what I mean? Because you think about, like, what's the success of, you know, if you're going to be, because we're all friends with Peter Billingsley also. And
Christmas Story.
And he cameoed in that. And has worked as either director or producer with us on different projects over the years. Somebody else who grew up, a good example of somebody who comes up through the business and learns the ropes and then continues to, you know, have an inspired career. And he, you know, it was interesting to know him because he was in Christmas Story.
Yeah.
And there, you know, the hope is that you could make a movie that could sit alongside of a film like that that's in rotation every year. Mm. I don't know if it still works this way. I think it does. Like TV would run there's a certain amount of films like It's a Wonderful Life and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and Charlie Brown, right? So to be in that pantheon of films that run in constant rotation around the holidays was always the hope. And we got to be there. And part of it was, remember, it's also after 9/11.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm from New York, and 9/11, you know, New York after 9/11, it just, everything, like, the music stopped. It was just, like, everybody thought of New York, they thought of that, and here we were filming a year later.
But there hasn't been, I mean, name the last hit, like, Christmas movie that's can sustain what Elf does. I can't think of it, unless there is one.
I don't even know if there are movies like that anymore. Like, everything is so on demand now.
Yeah.
I know that, like, there's a lot of chatter online about Elf every year. And I know, like, even though we didn't have merchandise made at the time, I see Christmas ornaments and blankets and costumes and ugly sweaters. So it's part of the culture. And now there's also people who grew up with these movies. So that's even stranger for me, because it's like, I'm introducing, it's our kids' first time watching Elf. And they'll, like, post a video of that.
Right.
And that to me is the best. Like,
that's really cool.
And if I had to pick one film I'm most proud of, like, it might be that one because it has such an intergenerational thing. It makes people feel a certain way around that time of year. and it feels like it's enduring, you know? And it felt old even when it came out because it was stop motion and forced perspective. We didn't have a lot of CGI in it.
Right. Yeah.
So, and that a lot of that was budget too. It's like we couldn't afford CGI.
I saw the behind the scenes of it too, the making of it. And it was like what you did with the angles to make Will... It's so easy and simple.
It's an old trick.
Yeah.
Yeah, like from Darby O'Gill and the Little People. I mean, that's and Lord of the Rings used it too.
What about Faison in that? How great was Faison?
I know. If I land on a scene from that, it's him and Will arguing with each other in the North Pole.
Yeah.
We'll be right back.
Thank you to Organic Valley for supporting the show. I'm just finishing up a little cottage cheese here. See, the thing is, I'm always on the hunt to find the best dairy products. But so many options out there. Which one do you choose? With Organic Valley, you can feel good choosing their dairy products. Their products are ethically sourced from small family farms where cows spend lots of time grazing outside on organic pasture. Organic Valley Dairy doesn't come from those big factory farms. Their farmer families are real people who care about people, animals, and nature. It just tastes better. You can taste the organic. For me, look, I'm a coffee guy, okay? Guilty as charged. Every morning, I do the same thing, which is I come downstairs, I make my coffee, and the thing that this so important ingredient is my half and half. And I just happen to choose Organic Valley half and half even before they started supporting the show. I mean, talk about a match made in dairy heaven. And I also happen to enjoy their eggs and their butter and their other products too. So I was going to say, so sue me, but so don't sue me. When you choose Organic Valley, not only will you enjoy a great tasting organic dairy, you'll help to save over 1,600 small organic family farms who are protecting over 400,000 acres of organic farmland and all the plants and animals they call it home. And do not ask me to convert that to hectares. To find Organic Valley Dairy near you, visit ov.coop. We get support from Happy Egg. I love starting my morning off with farm fresh eggs full of flavor. At Happy Egg, all of their hens roam on 8 or more acres of land, leaving no mystery to why their eggs are the best. These hens are raised on 8 plus acres. I got to keep it down because if my hens find out, they don't have 8 plus acres. My hens only have like 3/4 of an acre. And, going to go on strike. Anyway, all of their hens are cared for by small family farmers and live their best hen lives day in and day out. All of this results in eggs with plump orange yolks that are full of flavor. I just, as I mentioned, I like to kick off my morning with farm fresh eggs. The difference is so glaring between an egg from Happy Egg and an egg that just came from clearly some kind of like sad factory. And you just have to taste it for yourself. If you're a fan of eggs, which I am, do yourself this favor and try Happy Egg eggs. You will not be disappointed. You will notice the difference immediately. Get with the Happy Eggs. They're so good. Next time you're at the store, look for the yellow carton. Choose Happy with Happy Egg. Visit happyegg.com/smartless to find a store near you. And if you come by the house, don't mention it to my aunts.
My dad works in B2B marketing, but I never really knew what that meant. Then one day, my dad came by my school for career day and told everyone in my class he was a big ROAS man. Then he just kept saying things like, the bigger the ROAS, the better, over and over. My friends still laugh at me to this day. I think it means calculating a return on ad spend. One thing's for sure. I'll be known as the ROAS man's kid for the rest of my days. Why couldn't you just be a fireman or a lawyer? Why? You ruined my life, Dad.
Not everyone gets B2B, but LinkedIn has the people who do. And with ads on LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people based on job title, industry, likelihood to buy, and more. Start converting your B2B audience into high-quality leads today. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/smartlist to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/smartlist. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
From visionary filmmaker Luca Guadagnino comes Challenger, starring Zendaya, Josh O'Connor, and Mike Feist. Zendaya stars as Tashi Duncan, a former tennis prodigy turned coach who has taken her husband Art and transformed him into a world-famous Grand Slam champion. To jolt him out of his recent losing streak, she makes him play a challenger event close to the lowest level of the pro tournament. Her strategy takes a turn when he finds himself standing across the net from his former best friend and Tashi's former boyfriend, Patrick. Past and present collide and tensions run high. Tashi must ask herself, what will it cost to win? See Challengers only in theaters April 26th. Get tickets now at ChallengersMovie.com.
And now, back to the show.
So, you know, I mean, we touched on this already, but you're part of one of the biggest movie companies now, Marvel, and then you go over to Disney and the Star Wars franchise, and how in the world did you get over there? Like, it's unbelievable.
Well, I was working on finishing The Lion King. And those movies take it takes a few years to finish because you're overseeing animation, visual effects, finaling all that stuff. So you have to be attentive. You can't go off and do something else because you have to approve shots as soon as they come out just to keep the machine going.
Right.
But it's still not a full-time job because you're not going to set every day. So for a couple hours each day, you have to be available. But you can't go off and do something else because it just takes a lot of meticulous, concentration to get every shot right. But it doesn't require all your time. And so I started thinking about, they had talked about Disney Plus launching and that we're going to have TV shows and maybe Marvel stuff. And I had talked to Kathy Kennedy years before when Star Wars moved over to Disney, was sold from Lucasfilm, about the notion of maybe working on a movie. I was a fan of Star Wars, and so I pitched her. I just went in there and pitched the idea for The Mandalorian of a very simple story about it was the first scene, bounty hunter walks into a bar.
So great.
This happens. And so she was into it. They were very busy because they had the last movie of the Skywalker saga that they were getting ready to release. So that was their main focus. So we started talking about doing a deal. Next thing, I just started writing. So by the time they actually hired me, I had written 4 episodes of it.
Wow.
And so I brought that in. I was like, this is what I want to do. And I can't leave town because I'm finishing Lion King, which is a big deal for Disney, which is the same parent company, right? And that's how we built, that's how we got the support to build the volume and develop that filming system you were talking about.
I was going to say, so did the stagecraft come before Mandalorian or the Mandalorian?
No, after. Because once we started to do Mandalorian, I said, look, here's some tech. There was some technology I was aware of, and it was the type of thing where everybody knew you could do it, but nobody did it.
Yeah.
Right.
And so I came in and said, okay, here's the goal. And we assembled a group of people, ILM, Unreal, Lux Screens, Magnopus. There were a bunch of tech partners that came together along with my company, Golem Creations, and we all got together and started to work out how you would do this. And we didn't know that you could actually accomplish so many shots in camera. It was an experiment at the time. But we started doing little tests, even when I was working on Lion King, where you'd move the camera, you'd have a TV screen, and you'd see the backgrounds move. And it seemed very promising. So part of that was to allow me to finish this big, high-priority film, Lion King, for them without leaving town.
Yeah.
And start to prep and work on this. And that's why there were other directors that came in. I wrote pretty much almost all the scripts. That's something else I learned really is helpful too, is to have a unified voice, to be very involved with the writing process and not have it. You could have other people direct it, but to have a consistent voice in the writing is really helpful.
Any questions for John?
Yeah, bring Scotty over.
Scotty, you want any?
What do you want to know?
Keep it loose, Sean.
Yeah. Baby Yoda's right 50 years old.
I love the way he screams at Scotty.
Hey, like, what's going on?
I wrote down a question.
You did?
Let's hear the question.
Let's hear it.
Well, you ask it.
You ask Tracy. Scotty, get on the mic here.
A guest question. Caller?
Okay, so here's my question. I know it's long.
Eat the mic.
You've probably been asked this 1,000 times.
There we go.
So I apologize. obviously, The Mandalorian is such a phenomenal show. We love Star Wars. We love it so much.
Are you crying, Scotty?
And it's a great show for filling in the gaps for some of our favorite characters from the original Star Wars, you know, movies like Luke and, you know, who's made a few appearances. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I'm sure some of us fans were wondering, could we possibly see any of our other favorite characters show up? Maybe in upcoming episodes who we know to be alive at this point in time?
It's like we're at Comic-Con.
I know. Hi, I'm Scott from Los Angeles.
You know, first of all, I can't really answer that one. But I would say that part of what we try to do with The Mandalorian is... I'll still answer.
He can hear. His phone.
Is it one of those things? I'll hang up and take the answer off air, like on NPR.
Yeah.
Right. I think the important thing is for us is that there's so many different areas of Star Wars and that we could bring all of it together into one show and pull in things from the sequels, from the prequels, from the original trilogy, from the animated, and even the extended universe.
Yeah, it's kind of, it's amazing.
It felt like Star Wars was splitting into a lot of different areas, and part of what we want to do is pull it all together because, you know, Star Wars is a big tent, you know? Yeah. And whether it's kids who are growing up watching Clone Wars or millennials who had the prequels, like everybody's invited to the party. Yeah. And so sometimes it makes sense. In the case of Luke Skywalker, as we were figuring out if he had to bring him to a Jedi and who that Jedi would be, it wouldn't have made logical sense for it to be anybody but Luke. So we always want the story to point us there.
How about that CGI on Mark Hamill just come? I mean, that was unbelievable. That was crazy.
What's also crazy is if you look at the difference between the first time we did it and the next time we did it, you'll see how much all of that AI-based deepfake.
It's like Mark Hamill was 20 years old again. I mean, it's nuts.
God, you fucking people need to read a book. Jesus Christ.
All right. What you know what we got to talk about? G-Force. Yeah. That's the movie we did together.
You son of a bitch.
We're both in it.
We are both in it.
That's the only time we work together.
You, me, Galifianakis. Bill Nye.
You know what Galifianakis told me after that? He said, I promised myself after that film that I would never read a script high before I accept the role, is what he said to me.
That's the end of that experiment. But let's
does everybody know what G-Force is? Hell, why are you moving off of this?
I want to get to Prehistoric Planet.
By the way, all my kids have gone through like 6 months where they've loved it when they're like four. Every single one of my kids.
It's a bunch of gerbils, right?
No.
It's
guinea pigs.
It's guinea pigs.
I
was one of the guinea pigs. I was the comic relief. I was the farting guinea pig. I'm sure your kids liked me. I was one of the favorites, right?
They loved that. I mean, they all loved it at various stages. So.
Hurley. I play Hurley. Anyway, okay, let's go on to Prehistoric Planet.
Now, how did that come about? And explain to Tracy in Wisconsin what the hell it is.
Tracy, there's a little something called Apple TV Plus. Mm-hmm. And if you get it, there's a documentary series that looks an awful lot and sounds an awful lot like Planet Earth with David Attenborough narrating, done by the BBC and Apple TV that I'm involved with. And we create a documentary as though you were able to bring a camera back into the prehistoric Cretaceous period.
Yeah, it's, wow. Yeah, it's
pretty cool. And the reason I'm working on it is, you know, it was a project that they were talking about doing, partnering up on, but because we had developed technology to create CGI that felt more cinematic and photoreal through all of our innovations on The Lion King, which if you recall, there was no actual photography in that. That was all CGI, but we built a VR environment that we filmed in. So we actually had the whole crew in VR filming segments around these animated characters.
Jesus.
And that's part of why it looks like a live action movie.
Try to explain that a little bit just so Tracy can understand what that means. Because I think building the environment that you're filming in VR is not an easy concept necessarily.
No, but it was the way to get...
Like my mom's at home. She's 76. No, sorry. God, she's almost 80.
Well, make sure you get it right.
Yeah.
Sure she's thrilled.
Yeah, there she is. Alex, she doesn't mind. She's not offended by stuff like that. So she's at home. How would you explain it to my mom, who's 80, what that means?
Sure, she's not 85 or something?
Calgary? What province?
Toronto. Calgary.
I don't know.
That team.
She's an Argo fan.
She's a big Argo fan. Okay, so, but explain it to somebody and to Tracy.
So virtual reality is something where you wear goggles and wherever you turn your head and move, you perceive through hearing and sight as though you're in that, immersed in that reality. So it's like a video game.
She understands that.
Okay. So we create the environment with artists as you would for CGI. We create the environment and the characters. And so if you're wearing your goggles, you could walk around and look at and interact with the environment and the characters. That allows us, like a multiplayer game, to bring the crew into that virtual environment. And so you could have a cinematographer and a gaffer in there setting lights up virtually. You could have a camera operator set up a camera. And we would, you know, if you came to our stages down there in Silicon Beach, down there off Jefferson, Culver City, that area, we had set up their camera systems without cameras, dolly tracks without cameras on them. We had sensors.
So all your crew is wearing goggles?
So some of them would be wearing goggles to scout, but you could also watch a screen because because a dolly grip isn't necessarily having to see a fully dimensionalized version of the performer. They just have to look at their marks. So they would tape marks off on a track and move the chassis. And that gave the whole thing a feel as though it was being filmed in live action.
Wow.
So by building these tools, it gave it that live action feel in addition to really good CGI that MPC was able to do, the house that we work with. So we had all these tools that we built around how do you make Lion King look live action? And we used those tools and applied them to the task of how do you create a show that looks like a documentary filmed in real life of dinosaurs. And so if you look at Prehistoric Planet, if you have Apple TV Plus, you could take a look at it. We've got a season up. We're getting ready to launch another that we're just finishing up now. And you could look on trailers if you don't have that and take a look at it. And then we had David Attenborough and just his voiceover just makes it. And it's all based in real science, which again I geek out on because I get to learn so much about the behavior. Archaeology has made so many breakthroughs in the last few years where you start to learn about how they reared their young, what they ate, where they lived, that they had feathers, they were colorful, they had, you know, it was a whole different sense of what dinosaurs were than when I grew up.
I forgot about that time. What were we doing? Was it a couples retreat? And and I went in your trailer
you
and
walked
you were
in my
watching,
I remember this.
Yeah, you were watching this series of videotapes at the time, I think,
that's
or DVDs.
It was DVDs. It was a box set. It was called Big History.
Yeah.
Big History. David Christian would teach a course in it. It was one of those, it was before, remember, it was before like podcasts or before digital. So we are watching on the viewer in the trailer. And Big History, I'm sure it's still available, was a fascinating course because it starts off with the Big Bang.
Yeah.
Talking about the world through the lens of physics. And then through the formation of the stars and planets. And then it talks about chemistry. And then it talks about geology as the planets formed. And then it eventually talks about anthropology.
Yeah,
and comes all the way through history to today with complex
systems.
Will,
you would love this.
And the patterns.
This sounds amazing.
It was just, I mean, I just go in there and we just watch the TV for like hours.
Jason, you said behind when you were like 16,
here we go.
On Ventura behind the Ralphs, you had a lot of chemistry on the Big Bang, right? You had a lot of chemistry on, right? You were 16.
And then I told you I had 3 callbacks for the show, The Big Bang. You've always been interested in I love that about you. There's so much about you that is beautifully silly. And without sort of pretense, and then there's another part of this super big brain in you, and you just you're a real inspiration, Mister.
Nice. Yeah. And also, does everybody know that we worked together? One of my first jobs in town.
God, that's right, right.
Well, we were on a pilot together.
Yeah. I think I got fired from that show. I think I might be confusing with another one, but I did get fired off of a pilot.
You were the big star. You were when they got you. That was the big win.
I got a phone call that I was going to be replaced, and then 48 hours later, I heard that they were actually not going to pick up the show. So I had the honor of being fired. Yeah,
before.
Being fired, and then the whole
maybe
show
maybe without
got fired.
Jason. No, let's not do it at all. Is that what happened?
Wait, what was it?
It was we played comedy writers on a like proscenium multicam sitcom pilot right. back in, like, it must have been like 92,
did Robbie
three?
Benson direct that? No, am I thinking of something
else? It may
else?
Have been. He directed a pilot that I did. Was it the same one? It might have been that
one. Our brains are going.
Because he directed a friend my friend's episode. I think he did direct. No, he directed. I don't know.
Anyway, it was. I loved you then. I love
we
you
got
now.
To work together, man. That was the big time for me.
Did you do you so remember sad. When you were working on Iron Man 2?
Yes. Justin Theroux.
And when, here well, we I was going to say, when you were reading this, when the pages.
Did he have sleeves back
yeah,
then?
When the pages were coming in, could you get the sense they were written by arms with no sleeves?
I
on
noticed
them?
That nobody had sleeves in the yeah. script, yeah. which I was curious about. That was one thing.
Like, I don't know if that's going to play.
That's his hallmark.
And the dog was going to start.
That's his hallmark.
Yeah. No, he was great. He was a writer. He had worked with. He was a writer on Tropic Thunder.
He and Ben Stiller wrote Tropic Thunder, and then Downey won. Yeah.
Downey was very big, you know, he was like, this is the guy that could, you know what I mean? Because it needs to be a voice, too, for Tony Stark. It wasn't just, you know, a lot of it came from him in the first one.
Yeah.
So I think that he had a really good experience with Justin. He's a very smart guy. And, like, again, another one who's an actor.
Actor,
but you
writer.
Talk to him about a lot yeah. of subjects. He yeah. knows he knows a lot about a lot of things. And just a really, you know, has a really good ear for
I saw,
dialogue.
He sent me a picture the other night, by the way, from New York. And great. And I love, you know, Theroux is one of our best buddies. But he did send me a picture from New York. Out at night, he thought he was taunting me, and it was 6 degrees in New York. I knew because I'd seen on the weather, and he was inside this establishment with no sleeves. And I was like, "Hey, man, it's fucking
like,
January."
If I had guns like that, you couldn't get sleeves on me either.
I would too.
John, what does it take for you to get excited enough to treat us all to some of your great acting? Or are you just so satisfied with?
No,
with,
I love doing
creative...
it. Well, with a guy like you,
but
you're funny as
sit?
Hell.
But where does it sit in your temptations? You know, I mean, does it have as much of a pull as directing does?
It depends who it's with and what it is, and it's not the same thrill as in the beginning when can I do this at all? Right?
Yeah.
And you just want to make sure that you're in a situation where you're with people that you're having a good time.
Right.
Because if you're not, I don't know that I could fake it as well as you need to.
Yeah.
And also, like, I love, look, when you get to work on your own stuff, you start, you have a lot of control over a lot of things.
Right.
And so you use that part of your brain. And when you go on somebody else's set, if you bring that energy, it's terrible. Like, you have to be a great... And actually, the people I've worked with who are the best actors are other filmmakers. Because they show up and they just want... Where do you want me to stand?
Right.
Uh-huh. They're like the first ones on their marks. And, like, that's how I am when I go on somebody else's set. And I like to do the... I've been doing the Marvel stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that's been really cool because I... To keep that connection. A lot of the characters that were around... are gone now. And I'm like one of the ones who's around since the first Iron Man. And I'm still there for the kids who grew up. I'm like the Hagrid of Marvel.
That's hysterical.
You know, like a hopefully like a friendly, goofy presence that offers some comfort.
All right. Last question. With all this smart stuff and great stuff that you're doing, what's the dumbest thing you find yourself doing on a daily or weekly basis? See, have you any guilty pleasures that the audience would be surprised by?
There's a podcast I listen to religiously.
Yeah, it'll rot your brain.
That's my dirty pleasure. Yeah. My guilty pleasure.
That qualifies.
I do love the podcast, and it's it started off as something where I didn't know if I liked it just because I knew all of you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was like, and I don't get out a lot. So I was like, oh, this is like hanging out and I'm just not talking.
Yeah.
Like I got to hang out with you guys. And I had no pressure to be funny, no pressure to go, you know, I didn't have to valet the car or drive. And then now that it's such a success and so many people, when I mentioned I was going to do this show, they were like really like jealous, like, oh my God, that's so fun. How do you get it? What are they like? So
nice
it's really great to watch you all do something that you did for fun.
Yeah.
Because you liked it and you were interested in it, turned into one of the most successful projects for all of you. You know what I mean? That this is like
such
a win.
Successful for me. 40 years. This is like the biggest, loudest thing I've ever done.
And I love that this moment rewards passion and authenticity that other people will seek it out and they sense it and they'll find it. And how relaxed everything is and all the things that we've all worked on together apart, there was this pressure in the background of, if you do this, you'll get to succeed, or we'll let you do more of this, or we'll pick up this pilot if it tests well.
Yeah.
And then this is the most unstructured. The concept is like one surprise guest, right, and we're going to talk, and everybody's drawn to it. And it just shows you that all those rules and all those structures and the gatekeepers, all of that is a function of the dynamic around the economics of the business. And then here you all come through and do something where it's all of you hanging out. And as somebody who's hung out with all of you, it really feels exactly that way. And that people get a glimpse of it and that they enjoy it. And it actually turns into, there's a business model to support it and a way to distribute, I think is really encouraging. And to people out there, you know, who are going to, you know, trying to figure out their way, it's a real lesson.
Yeah, and I was actually just saying that this morning. It was a real lesson to me that it shouldn't be a surprise that the thing that that I think for all three of us that we have pushed least on pressed least on in our careers has ended up being the most successful thing. And it is a great lesson. You just sort of just follow your instinct and just walk down the hill. And
well,
you know,
we've never, as you know, and John, as you got to witness when you were waiting, when we were first doing the intro, we never talk about what we're going to talk about. Here's the other thing we've all worked on. We've all worked on the Kyle Gass poker game back in the day, about 15 years ago when we all played. But it's very much that same dynamic, right? It's just sitting down at a table and just having a laugh, and we never talk about what we're going to talk about, ever, truly.
Well, thanks for having me on it. And,
dude, thank you for fucking coming on. Your story is awesome.
It's really cool. And I might add, when I see you and we hang out, however few and far between that is, I'm always so thrilled to see you and so enamored with you and everything that you do. I'm so giddy because I'm just like, you know, from the first time we met,
good dude,
20 decades or 2 decades ago. I mean, you know, it's really cool.
Thank you.
Also, John, I will implore you, from a guy who started doing Swingers again, which is so great, and then you went and you've gone to such lofty heights and all the MCU and then the Star Wars and all that stuff, and then in between that you do The Chef. I implore you to keep going back and please and give us another like indie like story, small story, please, because you're really good at that. You're really, really good at that.
Thank you, man. Yeah. Thank you all. And, you know, keep doing what you're doing. It's really wonderful. And it's wonderful also to feel like I could just jump on something like this and to feel like I've been hanging out with you all the way through, even though it's been a one-way street, and especially through the lockdown, you know what I mean? Through the pandemic, it was really nice to have your voices and your presence. And it just, everybody was so isolated, and I felt like it was really comforting, reassuring. And it's just enjoyable. And I'm glad that your guys are still going and that everybody recognizes.
And we can't wait for the next Avatar. That's you too, right?
Yeah, that's me. I'm
Avatar.
You do
that too. Sean, please check your texts, please.
Yeah.
John, well, thanks for being a part of it, buddy.
Yeah, thanks,
truly.
John.
Really appreciate it. And hopefully we'll see you soon in person.
All right.
Bye, John.
All right, buddy.
Bye, John.
Bye, pal. Thank you.
Bye. Oh, he's going to do it. He's going to
shit out of that.
He's going to slam it.
Shut the slam.
There it
shut
is.
Shut on that.
No, slam it.
I have a little switch on my thing I had installed just for Smartless. That goes over my camera. See?
Nice.
There it is.
Uh-huh. Perfect. Boy, I sure like that fella.
Yeah, that was great.
I mean,
it was so good to check in from him. You forget about how many things he's done in sort of different shapes and sizes, right?
Well, but amazing. I mentioned it earlier, comparing him to like George Lucas in the sense that like he not only tells great stories and makes things that we all want to see, but like the tech part of it too is like, there's not a lot of people who do that.
And he doesn't make a big thing about letting people know how many important things he's touched, how many things that we love that he's done that we might not realize he's been a part of. I just think that's really, cool.
Yeah.
I mean, think about it. He wrote Swingers and starred in Swingers with Vince. And then he directed Elf, one of the all-time, an absolute Christmas classic. I mean, in their top two.
Yeah, for sure.
Of
It's a Wonderful Life and Elf.
Yeah.
And the Swingers, Iron by the Man. Way, but before you go past that, like that kind of started a bit of a comedic style and tone. Yeah. And
well, it
and
set the tone called, for all the Marvel movies.
Well, no, it's Swingers. It just sort of set the Swingers. Tone for a lot of some of the comedies that populated, what was it, the 90s?
Yeah.
You know, and with like him and Vince starting to work through all those, and Stiller and Owen Wilson and Jack Black, and you sort of that wheel that it was sort of birthed, I think, right in there.
The comedy wheel. Remember the comedy wheel?
And then, then Elf and what that did for that films of that season. And then, and then, of course, what he did to set the tone for Marvel and all the other derivative films in that genre is pretty impressive.
So we didn't talk about the film.
Oh, here we go. I love the way he's teeing himself up.
It's unbelievable. It's
hey, guys, have you ever thought about...
You know, it's so embarrassing. And by the way, with this kind of build-up, better be...
It's really good. We didn't talk about the film that he actually acted in with Jason, which was... and Melissa McCarthy, which was... Identity thief.
Rejected at the gate.
Do you see how timid he was about it?
What the fuck?
Couldn't even say it above a whisper. You're so ashamed of it.
Fuck. Is Postmates at the door? Do you have to run? Is that why you're trying to get it?
I do have to pee.
Do you?
I do.
Before we let you go, because we're rejecting that. What's on the docket for dinner tonight?
Yeah.
You'll love this.
You'll love it.
It's roasted chicken with vegetables.
Scotty, what are we having for dinner? What else?
And some other stuff.
Some stuff.
And like mashed potatoes. Oh, mashed potatoes.
Basically like a holiday dinner tonight.
It actually does look like a holiday dinner.
Let's be honest. Is it chicken with mashed potatoes or is it mashed potatoes with chicken? And then what do we have? And then so no dessert, right?
So I don't know. We'll probably have chocolate chip cookies. But listen, once I'm done eating all of that and I have to leave the table, because to eliminate.
Because you can't eat another bite.
Bye.
Yes.
It's pathetic.
Bye.
Smart.
Smartless is 100% organic and artisanally handcrafted by Michael Grant Terry, Rob Armjarve, and Bennett Barbago.
Smartless.
If you like Smartless, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I'd just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity,
that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied.
Like a liar.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.